entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
Hello there. Welcome into a Sunday morning. It's the 6th day of May, and this is the Best of Downtown. Rich Kimble and Carrie Haskell here for our look back at some of our favorite recent conversations. Good stuff for you this morning on the program, brought to you as always by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Guests of the program come your way on the G&M Family Market phone line. You can find G&M at the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden. Open every day from 6 a.m. until 9 p.m. We'll talk with the authors today, primarily, one of whom also is an astronaut. But all three have produced terrific books. John Connolly, breaking out of the mold of detective stories, the Charlie Parker stories that he's been very successful with, for a brand new novelization of the life of a comedy icon. We'll hear from him in a moment. Astronaut Terry Virts, who's flown the space shuttle, been the commander of the International Space Station, and has also published a book on his photos from space and stories behind them. And author Robert Kersen, who wrote all about space and the trip to the moon of Apollo 8. That's what's ahead here this morning on Downtown, the Best Of Show. You hear Downtown every weekday afternoon from 4 to 6 on Z62 and on WKIT HD3. Downtown, the podcast, available everywhere. iTunes, Google Play. Subscribe, get it sent right to your device as well. It's pretty easy to do. Episode 1. Out there right now, featuring, among others, Bryan Cranston. Episode 2 drops this coming Wednesday with actor, writer, director, producer, and author Mark Duplass, and a whole lot more. Right now, let's get things rolling this morning. We had a wonderful conversation last week with author John Connolly, famous for the Charlie Parker series of detective stories. He's written some children's literature as well, and off into the world of fantasy, but his newest is a fictionalized story about comedy legend Stan Laurel. Bounces back and forth between his later years in a little apartment in Santa Monica and the story of him building his career and discovering his partner and longtime friend, Oliver Babe Hardy. The book is called He. John Connolly joined us this week on Downtown. I'm curious to know, what was it that made you want to inhabit the life of Stan Laurel?
Well, I'd grown up with him. I guess like Americans of a certain generation, they were omnipresent on television when I was growing up. If you were on vacation, you know, if they were trying to fill the schedule on a sunny afternoon, they would put on a Laurel Hardy film. And then a friend of mine, it turned out he'd met Stan Laurel just shortly before he died, because Stan Laurel spent the end of his life in a little apartment in Santa Monica, and he kept his name in the telephone book. So you could call him and go to meet him, and if he liked you, he would give you a hat. And I suppose I had always thought of them as figures from a black and white era, and yet he lived until 1965, until shortly before I was born. And yet he never worked after Oliver Hardy died, and that was what fascinated me. He was the man who was left behind. He was bereaved the same way that someone in a marriage is bereaved when their partner dies. And I simply couldn't and wouldn't work without him, and I thought there was something incredibly moving about that.
Yeah, and I love the fact that he even disliked doing any kind of personal appearances, because he didn't look the way people remembered him.
Yeah, there was that. When they were awarded, an Academy Award posthumously in the case of Oliver Hardy, and Stan Laurel pleaded illness. He wouldn't go along to the ceremony. And I think it wasn't just that he had grown older, but I think if he were to appear alone, people would always be conscious of the absence, you know, the man who should have been with him. And he didn't want people to think of them in that way. I think he didn't want to add that tone of sadness to their memories of them.
Well, it's such a fascinating book, and I think of myself as a movie buff, and yet I sat reading the book with my iPad next to me so I could search some of these people
that I
didn't know a lot about. I have a whole new appreciation, among others, for Bronco Billy Anderson from reading this book.
Yeah, even I didn't know that much about the early days of Hollywood before I started, simply how prolific these people were, how many of them were, how many films they were making, but also how ruthless it was. You know, I was particularly struck by the Three Stooges, who would probably be very familiar to a lot of American audiences. you know, they were treated so abominably by Harry Cohn, who was the head of their studio. You know, he didn't let them pull their punches. So that if you see violence in a Three Stooges short, somebody is being hurt to the extent that Curly ended up with bleeding on his brain. And yet Harry Cohn said to them, you know, you will keep taking punches because if you don't work, I will put you out on the street. And it was a very unforgiving environment. You had to be fairly tough to survive it. And, you know, Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy had a career that lasted pretty much 3 decades. They did very well to keep their head above the water, but a lot of people around them fell by the wayside.
Well, and it took a while for them to get together, and it took a long time for Stan Laurel to get to where he hoped he could be, and that was that pairing with the man that everyone knew as Babe that finally brought them that success. And this book to me, John, also reads very much like a love story on several levels. The love of women, lots of women, but the love that he had right until the end for Babe, and I thought the really poignant scenes of him writing scenes and practicing scenes for the two of them in that apartment in Santa Monica years after the death of Oliver Hardy.
Yeah, I think even after Ollie died, he would still write routines for them, but he would never allow them to be performed by anyone else. And I think it was a way for him to hear that man's voice again and have him present in the room. Because as you say, between them, they clocked up 8 marriages and at least 2 to 3 mistresses. You know, they were, we think of them as very simple men. Maybe we confuse the image on the screen with real life, but they were adult men with adult problems. And their relationship with each other outlasted so many of these marriages. It was the true romance in their lives. And I think, you know, male friendship is sometimes underestimated, particularly by women who, you know, we don't express our emotions terribly well. A lot of it appears to be on the surface. And yet, throughout their lives, in their loyalty towards each other, in the tenderness they show towards each other, particularly the tenderness that Stan Laurel shows towards Oliver Hardy when Oliver Hardy is dying, you can see that there was a real depth of emotion there. And that was one of the things that interested me, to write about that affection and friendship that men can have for each other.
We're talking with John Connolly about his wonderful new book, He. Women do not fare very well in this story, and it's not just those who become involved and then are cast aside by Laurel and Hardy, but the many that Charlie Chaplin goes through and on and on. These were difficult times to be a woman, particularly if she happened to work in the film industry.
Oh, it was. It was immensely difficult. You know, the Me Too movement at the moment is a kind of culmination of things that began right at the beginning of Hollywood. Yeah, women were cast aside pretty readily. They were not paid as much. They were subject to violence. And, you know, if stars could get away with things because they made the studios money. And Chaplin is the great example. There is no denying Chaplin's genius. You know, at least 2 to 3 of the 10 greatest comedies ever made are Chaplin comedies. But we forget that he had a very dark side. You know, Chaplin had relationships with underage girls. You know, he got one of them pregnant and had to marry her. There's a real shadow there, and it's the difficulty we sometimes face in separating this lovely eighth line. How do we separate the dancer from the dance? You know, can we look at the art and appreciate it while knowing that some of the people involved in it behaved abominably? You know, Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy didn't. I think Stan Laurel was just a man who, he needed domestic stability so he could make his strange art. And he would rather be with the wrong person than be alone. And that's a recipe for disaster. And I think that was one of the reasons why he accumulated so many marriages before he eventually found the right person to settle down with.
Chaplin is very much lurking over Stan Laurel throughout this book. And he looks at him with both awe and respect, but does not seem to like him much as a person. How much of that was a literary device for you? Because I know, at least in his public statements, Laurel tried to steer clear of much controversy.
He did. In his letters, he's very, very circumspect. But one letter came up for sale a little bit earlier this year, and it's clear that he has a certain ambivalence towards Chaplin. I mean, he hugely admired Chaplin. He thought he was a godlike genius. And he and Chaplin stayed in touch throughout Stan Laurel's life. But a lot of the traffic was from Chaplin's side. If Chaplin was feeling homesick or lonely, he would call Stan Laurel because they had the shared experience. They were both British. They had both roomed together when they started out in their careers. But when Stan Laurel was in trouble, Chaplin didn't help him. And towards the end of his life, I think Chaplin was quite envious of Stan Laurel. Chaplin was living in exile in Switzerland, essentially, having been hounded out of America by the FBI. And Stan Laurel was being rediscovered and reappreciated. And I think what Chaplin realized was that people might have admired him, but they loved Stan Laurel. You know, this train of comics, Jerry Lewis, Dick Van Dyke, the great mime artist Marcel Marceau, all made the pilgrimage to Santa Monica to visit Stan Laurel and talk to him. And I think Chaplin found a way to get revenge at the end of his life. I think he did something very unpleasant in his autobiography, which is kind of, obviously I won't say what it is, but it's one of the themes that runs through the book, the nature of Chaplin's autobiography and how it affected Stan Laurel. And I think that was a very deliberate decision on Charlie Chaplin's part to hurt Stan Laurel.
It's interesting, too, a couple of other comedy giants who play significant roles in the story. Buster Keaton, who was not a pleasant man to be around, apparently, and certainly, as many of the men did, enjoyed their liquor more than they should.
Well, that was his problem. I think Keaton's problem was just that he was an alcoholic. Stan Laurel was quite fond of him. He would often have a round and they would play cards together. But Keaton was such an alcoholic that he once married a woman who was as much an alcoholic as he is. And when she woke up in the morning after their wedding night, she couldn't remember his name. You know, and we've all done odd things when we've had a couple of drinks on us. But waking up with a wedding ring on you and looking at the person beside you and going, "Who are you?" is pretty extreme.
Yeah.
So they were kind of colorful characters. And Stan Laurel was very close to Lou Costello, which was an odd pairing in a way, because he wouldn't really have appreciated Lou Costello's comedy, which was a bit too zany, I think, for his liking. But he liked Lou Costello as a person. And I think part of that was that they had both lost children. You know, they both lost sons in infancy. And it's strange the things that bring people together. I think they were united by a certain grief.
It's interesting, too, his view of Harold Lloyd, who, and I love the distinction that's made, and I'm not sure, I don't believe it's Stan Laurel who makes it in the book, that many of these guys were comedians. Harold Lloyd is an actor who happens to act in comedies.
Yeah, and I think that was the same true of Stan Laurel as well. And I think that was a distinction. We have to remember that the vaudeville theaters essentially emptied into Hollywood, and anybody who could walk in a straight line without falling over potentially had a career. But a lot of these people weren't actors. They simply had some stage routines or a stage persona that they felt could transfer onto the screen. The ones who had real longevity were people like Harold Lloyd, Stan Laurel, and Chaplin. You know, Chaplin was not only a great actor, he was directing these films. He was funding them himself. You know, he was creating this extraordinary cinematic art that hadn't, in comic terms, hadn't really been seen before. So they're very distinct individuals compared to the others. The problem Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy had is that they were always employees. They never owned their product, whereas Harold Lloyd owned his own films. Chaplin owned his own films. So they became incredibly wealthy, whereas Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy were always struggling for money.
And Hal Roach had staggered their contracts, so neither of them were ever free at the same time. Hal Roach is such a fascinating character in the book, and I love this description that you have. Hal Roach has his faults, principal among them being a profound imbalance between the length of his arms and the depth of his pockets.
Well, I think that's probably true. There was a rumor that Hal Roach cheated them, and he never cheated them. He never paid them more money than he had to. So by the standards of other actors, they weren't hugely well paid. By the standards of the time, they were quite wealthy. But I think every artist makes a compromise. And the compromise Stan Laurel made for much of his career was that he would get paid a little bit less, but he would have more artistic control. And Hal Roach pretty much gave them artistic freedom as long as they stayed within the budget. He was able to do whatever he wanted. When they moved to Fox later and MGM, they got paid more money, but they had no artistic control at all. And those films are awful and get progressively worse. So, you know, you could argue he made a kind of devil's bargain for his art, but it was one that I don't think he ever really regretted.
Well, the book is so terrific to read. I loved it. It's incredibly sad at times. Stan Laurel did not have an easy life, and yet to me, I found it also uplifting. You mentioned the hats earlier, and I love the story that he kept the closet full of derby hats that he would replenish and give out to special visitors, even though his wife made fun of him for that.
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, there have been a lot of dramas and films and books about miserable comedians, and these were not miserable men. You know, they endured sadness through their lives, but every life will have a little bit of it. But at the end of his life, I think there was a kind of contentment with Dan Laurel. I think he had this extraordinary life with this extraordinary man who had been by his side for so much of it, and he missed him deeply. But out of it came this really, really wonderful art. And at the end of it, sometimes when you write a book about someone you've admired, you find out things about them that make you dislike them. All I found out made me appreciate his art more. In the end, he was a kind, decent man, and I think Oliver Hardy was too. And something of that shows through in their art, I hope.
It certainly does, and I love their work for as long as I can remember. But my appreciation, not only for them, but for the whole industry and the birth of that industry, is so much greater from reading this book. I feel a lot smarter about the movie business, but particularly about Stan Laurel and Babe Hardy. John Connolly, a wonderful book. Thank you so much for visiting with us.
Oh, you've been a gentleman, Rich. Thank you so much for your interest.
That's John Connolly on Downtown, the author of the book He on the Best of Downtown. When we return, we'll go into space with astronaut Terry Virts, talk about his experiences and his book, View from Above. It's next on The Best of Downtown.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Biking season is here, and the only way to be sure that you're road or trail ready is to bring your bike to Slipping Gears Cycling, Bangor's only full-time cycling sales and service experts at 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor before prime riding season slips away. Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, Bangor's best full-service bike shop. Outstanding service, huge stock. Like them on Facebook for updates, shop in person and online at slippinggears.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Bennett Auto Center is the place to go for full-service auto care. From oil changes to engine jobs, they can handle your every need. Stop in at 24 Thatcher Street in Bangor and talk with the experienced local people at Bennett's. They offer great service, competitive prices on a wide range of tires, and best of all, people you can trust. Visit the website for more information at BennettAutoCenter.com. Give them a call at 947-0351.
Penobscot Theater presents...
A young, mysterious girl arrives at a rundown grill.
Hartford, Houston,
people Havisburg, who work at the grill have a contest.
Something's cooking up.
People write in explaining why they should own the Spitfire Grill. In the end, something magical happens. Come see the Spitfire Grill, April 26th through May 13th at Bangor's Historic Opera House. Tickets at 942-3333 and penobscottheater.org.
Green Acres Kennel Shop in Bangor will once again host free education events for pet parents this May. Join Don Hansen, co-owner of Green Acres Kennel Shop, for Why Shock Collars Can Be Harmful to Our Dogs and Humane Alternatives to Electrical Shock. This free seminar will be held on Tuesday, May 8th at 6:30 p.m. and Saturday, May 12th at 2:30 p.m. Don is a certified dog behavior consultant and a certified professional dog trainer. He will review the scientific, peer-reviewed literature on shock as well as recommendations on humane and effective alternatives to electric shock collars. On Saturday, May 19th at 10 a.m., Green Acres Kennel Shop will present Dog Behavior, Body Language, and Dog Parks with Don Hansen. In this free seminar, Don will address what you need to know about canine behavior and canine body language to make sure your visit is safe and fun for all. Learn more about these free educational events at the Green Acres Kennel Shop Facebook page.
We love Green Acres Kennel Shop, our home away from home.
Hi, this is Mike Toole. My company is ClearPoint Financial. We're an independent retirement plan advisory firm located right here in Bangor, Maine. At ClearPoint Financial, we provide guidance-based, comprehensive retirement plan solutions to companies that are concerned about their employees' retirement income security. We focus on plan participants, We help them strive to achieve retirement income security. We provide ongoing engagement, education, investment advice, and service that exceeds expectation. For more details on our financial wellness programs, call me today at 899-2552. ClearPoint Financial, the official financial advisor of the Maine Black Bears.
Back on the best of downtown, your Sunday morning. Yeah, time for us to go to outer space with our next guests on the program. First, astronaut Terry Burritz. He commanded the space shuttle Endeavour, flew on the Soyuz, and was commander of the International Space Station. He's also published a recent book entitled View from Above, featuring his photographs from space. Here's our conversation from Thursday's Downtown with Terry Burritz.
Good to be with you, Rich.
Well, how did your time in space, and you've logged, over 200 days in space, how did the time up there impact your view of the world down here?
You know, that's I do a lot of speaking now about that very subject. When you get to see Earth for the first time, it's really an emotional experience. I had spent my whole life reading books about space and, watching the IMAX movies, and I kind of thought I was ready for it. But the first time that you see your planet down there and you're not on it, it's really kind of an amazing experience.
We had Robert Kersen on last week, and he's written the wonderful book Rocket Men on Apollo 8 and talking about the experiences that Frank Borman and Jim Lovell and Bill Anders had seeing Earth from coming around from the dark side of the moon for the first time. And I have to think that there's no way that can't change a person when you see the fragility of it all. And it bears repeating that we are all alone here as a species on this little blue marble floating around in space.
Yeah, it's funny. Kids, I'll always ask, what's your favorite planet? And, you know, Jupiter's cool because it's big and Saturn has rings and Mars. Hopefully we'll be sending people there eventually. But having flown in space and seen those from space, Earth is my favorite planet. It's the only one we've got. And it's really a beautiful planet. The IMAX movie that I helped make is called Beautiful Planet. And it's very well named. It's a very appropriate name for a movie.
Well, the photographs in the book are so stunning, so very beautiful. What's the key to being a successful space photographer?
You know, I think that is a great question. I don't know that anybody has asked me that before. I think the key to being any photographer in space or with your kids or in nature is just being willing to get your eyes up and look around and see things. There's so many great images and views that you can capture if you just take a minute to look around and see it and, you know, try and imagine, hey, this would make a good picture and take it. And then, as they say, film is cheap, especially nowadays that it's digital. And so you just have to take shots. I ended up taking over 300,000 still images. There's some poor guy at NASA whose job it was to count that. And so when I got back, I think they were really happy that I had landed because I took a lot of pictures, but you got to take that many just to get a few good ones.
Mentioned that you flew on Soyuz. You were commander of the International Space Station. So I ask this, do scientists have the market cornered on international cooperation?
Well, what a world we live in nowadays. Things it's in so many ways that there hasn't been a lot of international cooperation, but in space, it's a very different story. In fact, from my time as commander, I think the thing I was most proud about was the way that we worked together with the Russians. I mean, I was in space with three cosmonauts and an Italian astronaut and an American. And we worked together as one crew. One of my goals as commander was to still be friends when it was all over. And we're all still friends. We still email each other and see each other when we can. And during all of this, you know, things have been pretty bad between the U.S. and Russia for years now. And I trained and flew right in the middle of that. And despite those problems, we were interested in space in things like staying alive. You know, when you're in outer space, that's not easy to do. So we didn't have time for all the political shenanigans that were happening down here on the planet. We were happy to, you know, make it through the day and get the mission done.
We're talking with astronaut Terry Burritz here on Downtown. I mentioned the number of days you've spent in space. What's the biggest challenge in acclimating to not only being in space, but being in fairly confined quarters?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. There's the physiological things, and they generally work themselves out after a few days or a week or two. But the psychological is a much bigger thing. But as far as your body goes, everybody has some type of headache or stuffiness. All the fluid goes from your legs and kind of floats up into your head, so you get a puffy head. I had a really bad headache until my third day in space. And it's, you feel dizzy. It's like hard to move your head very fast. And for me, on the morning of my third day, it was like a light switch went off, and all of a sudden I felt great. And I never again had any problems. But the first 2 days, I had a pretty bad headache. But a lot of people have back pain because you actually stretch out and grow a few inches usually. So there's all these kind of aches and pains that you get with going into space. And then after a few days or sometimes a week or two, those go away and you're adapted. And I was a spaceman. I mean, it was like all of a sudden I felt completely at home and natural in that very alien environment. But the psychological aspect of being not on your planet, you know, gone from your friends and family, and you're there with your crewmates and there's no one else. Like, there was no one else coming, at least not for a few months. So that's, for us, and when I was commander on Expedition 43, we had a great crew and we got along, but that, I think, is the biggest challenge.
What did you make of the news, and were you surprised by the news about Scott and Mark Kelly and the fact that after all that time in space, now these two twins don't have the same DNA?
You know what? That was actually, that reporting was not exactly accurate. There were some tweets and reports that didn't come out. And again, I'm a fighter pilot. I'm not a biologist, but there's a thing called gene expression. So their gene expression changed by 7%. But apparently that can happen if, like, I was just golfing this morning. And if you have a bad round of golf and you're stressed out, your gene expression changes. Or, you know, if you're running or whatever, day-to-day life can change that. Their actual DNA, it's a great question. I asked this when I got back because radiation-induced DNA change is a big deal. The cancer risk to astronauts is the biggest risk for long-term spaceflight. And NASA doesn't study that at all. They don't look at all between how your DNA changes before and after space. I think they did a short-term, one-of-a-kind study on Scott Kelly for one type of DNA, but they don't do generic DNA changes on astronauts. And that surprised me. I hope that's something that we start to do because it's an important issue. Mark and Scott, to be clear, Mark and Scott still have the same DNA.
Thank you for clarifying that. You mentioned you grew up reading about space and following space, and I'm a little bit older than you, but I was a huge space fan as a kid. I could have, for many years, told you every single crew in the Gemini and the Apollo launches through the years. It's interesting to me, talking last week about Apollo 8, that crew in their 80s and 90s still alive, and so many of these early astronauts have lived well into their 80s and 90s. Maybe Tom Wolfe was right about you guys having the right stuff.
Well, one of the things about being an astronaut, it's a pretty highly selected group. Like, you can't become an astronaut without going through lots and lots of medical tests. So if you have, you know, any one of a number of medical conditions, you just won't get picked. So once you get to be an astronaut, the odds of living a long time are pretty good. There are the effects of space flight, but, you know, the normal things that kind of kill you off, astronauts are mostly selected out of that population. So yeah, guys, you know, Buzz and Charlie Duke is in great shape and Harrison Schmitt's in great shape. And, a lot of these guys are, you know, there's not that many of them left, but they're living well and lots of energy. It's impressive.
Back here on Earth, you had a pretty amazing experience recently. Can you talk about your time in Antarctica?
Oh, God, that was amazing. So there's a, I had a chance to go down. I was kind of like the guest speaker on this tour. They have a base camp near the ocean. It's actually right near a Russian and Indian government science camps. There's a company called White Desert that does these tours. So we flew down from South Africa, which by the way, South Africa is an amazing experience by itself. And we went around. We were supposed to go see emperor penguins, but the weather down there didn't cooperate. And you're at the mercy of Mother Nature when you're in Antarctica. But I got to go all the way to the South Pole, to the Amundsen Scott Research Center there. The Americans have this humongous, gigantic facility right at the South Pole. And it was incredible. I've never seen any landscape like that. There's this place called Queen Maud Land, and the mountains there were not like any mountains I've ever seen. It was really, it was almost like an alien landscape there in Antarctica.
We're talking with Terry Virts. His wonderful book is entitled View from Above, An Astronaut Photographs the World. We've got a launch coming up on Saturday to Mars, the InSight lander. What should be the future of our space program, Terry, and especially in terms of manned space flight? Where do we go from here?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've actually written some articles about that. And I think the 21st century destination is Mars. There's so many interesting things about the planet. It's the most Earth-like place in the solar system. And, you know, the potential for people to live there over the long term is higher there than anywhere else that we're aware of. You can actually, if you have a small telescope, during the right season, you can see water on Mars. The polar ice caps are visible in just a small telescope. So there's a lot of reasons to go to Mars. It's a really difficult problem to get there, though. The movie The Martian was great. The science in it was really interesting and spot on. But the big thing about the movie was this giant Mars ship kind of showed up out of nowhere and took the crew there and then brought them back. And that's a minor detail. Is building that Mars ship is what the hard challenge is. And so I think we ought to be using the moon as a testing ground. There's some technologies that you need to get to Mars that I think we should start developing. One of them is nuclear power. You need that to generate the electricity for people, either on the moon or on Mars or wherever. If you're going to stay for any length of time, you need that. And the other thing is, if you had nuclear power that could generate megawatts of electricity, you could have an electric propulsion system that could get you to Mars and back in less than a year. And if you use a normal rocket, the kind that we use, you know, a chemical rocket that we've been using for the last 50 years, the trip actually takes 3 years because it's so slow. You have to wait for Earth and Mars to kind of go around the sun and line up again before you come home. So you can take the length of a trip from 3 years down to 1 year if you have that electric propulsion. So I think we should be developing those technologies now to eventually send us back to Mars, or not back to Mars, to Mars for the first time as people.
And Terry, what can we learn by having actual human beings in space that robots, that lunar rovers, that Martian landers can't teach us?
Yeah, so the rovers are great, by the way, and I love science and I love robotic exploration and I love following and seeing what they discover. But of course, humans are way better. The Spirit and Opportunity rovers have some good friends that were some of the main scientists on that program. And they had been there for like a decade, and they had traveled a total, I forgot the number, 1 kilometer or maybe a few kilometers. Basically, one human EVA or one human spacewalk could have covered the distance that it took these little guys a decade to do. Now, the difference is they're way cheaper, and they were able to do it. So there's an advantage there. But people are just adaptable. They're flexible. They see things. They can learn better. And one of the goals of exploration is to learn about the place we're going. But another goal is to be able to live there ourselves. And unless you send people there, you're not actually living there. So if we want to, you know, eventually settle space and move to other planets and other solar systems, we have to do that with people. You can't do that with robots.
You can follow Terry Virts on Twitter at AstroTerry. He's got a terrific website with a great blog at terryvirts.com. The book is View from Above, An Astronaut Photographs the World. Terry, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for making time for us today.
Great talking to you guys. Thanks.
Astronaut Terry Virts here on the Best of Downtown for your Sunday morning, brought to you by Quirk Motor City Used Vehicle Center with locations in Augusta, Bangor, Belfast, and Portland. It's your car. Find it at quirkauto.com. More space talk when we come back. The journey of Apollo 8, chronicled by author Robert Kurson in his new book, Rocket Men. That conversation next on the Best of Downtown.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Angelo's Pizzeria has locations in both Bangor and in Hamden, and they're your home for the best pizza, homemade pasta, and Italian takeout. Angelo's Pizzeria, located on Hammond Street in Bangor and Main Road South in Hamden, features a menu that also includes seafood, sandwiches, wraps, and salads. That means there's sure to be something for every member of the family. Stop into Angelo's Pizzeria, Hammond Street, Bangor, Main Road South in Hamden.
Spring's the time for everything new, fresh, innovative. Time for the brand new, all redesigned Ram 1500 at Hartley's.
The 2019 Ram 1500 is awesome, with more everything, more storage,
more performance,
more technology,
more efficiency,
and more leather.
In the new Ram 1500, there's safety all around you. It's the strongest Ram ever, capable, built to serve,
rugged,
and refined.
Start your own rebellion. Get yourself a Ram 1500 at Hartley's.
Don't miss the 2018 Jeep Wrangler, an all new version of a true icon at Hartley's.
Diesel power, hybridization, and full-wheel, all-wheel driver options. Wrangler is legendary for sport, fun, and work. The incredible 2018 is the most accommodating and comfortable Wrangler yet.
The new Ram 1500 and the all-new 2018 design Jeep Wrangler. Check them out at Hartley's.
The best deals on new Ram 1500s and 2019 Jeep Wranglers aren't in the city, they're in the country. Hartley's Country in Newport. Hartley'sCountry.com.
Your home should be your sanctuary, the place that keeps you safe and warm in the winter and cool and dry in the summer. The people at Penobscot Home Performance want to make sure your home is safe, healthy, comfortable, and energy efficient. They take a big picture view with practical steps and use their experience to ensure that the space and systems in your house are working better together. Contact them today for a free energy consultation by visiting PenobscotHomePerformance.com.
Go Blue!
Sir, you're here for the cheerleading tryouts?
Yeah, for the class of 82. Gotta show my school spirit.
I know a better way. The UMaine Alumni Signature Rewards Visa Card from University Credit Union. Low rates, no annual fees, and it earns reward points for travel, merchandise, or cash back.
Woo, sounds easier than a backflip.
Apply online today at UMaineAlumniCard.com.
Federally insured by NCUA. Terms and conditions apply, subject to credit approval.
At this busy time of year, there's nothing better than a place that offers you one-stop shopping. That place is G&M Family Market on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden. Fresh produce delivered daily, a great selection of meats and seafood, beer and wine, of course, a Dunkin' Donuts and an Amato's right on site. Stop into G&M Family Market every day of the week from 6 in the morning till 9 o'clock at night, and if they don't have what you're looking for, they'll make every effort to get it next time. G&M Family Market, Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden.
She packed my bags last night, pre-flight. 0 hour, 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then.
Our next guest on Downtown has written a remarkable book on the first journey to the moon, Apollo 8, 50 years ago, with astronauts Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders, a trip that astronauts and others inside NASA say to this day was the most dangerous, risky, and important flight that the space program ever undertook, coming just months after the failure of Apollo 6 and not long after the deaths of three astronauts in Apollo 1. It makes for a wonderful book entitled Rocket Men. Here's our conversation with author Robert Kersen. Even somebody who knows space pretty well and was a big space fan growing up, so much that I learned from the book as well. And I guess let's start with this, the fact that this flight in December of 1968 was every bit and perhaps even more high risk than the flight to the moon that featured the landing just 7 months later. There was so much at stake for not only the astronauts, but for the space program itself.
The space program itself and for the country itself, because remember, 1968, you can make a very powerful argument, was one of the worst years in our country's history. You have the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. You have violence in the streets, including in my hometown of Chicago at the Democratic Convention. You have 15,000 dead Americans in Vietnam. It seems that the whole country is divided against itself. Nobody can come together, it seems, on anything. And yet, at the very end, in the final hours of this terrible year, humanity is going to try something it's never tried before, and that's to leave its home planet and to arrive at a new world, the moon.
Well, and all of this happening on the heels of the biggest tragedy the space program had experienced at that time, the fire on the launch pad of Apollo 1 that killed three astronauts, and then also the failure of Apollo 6.
That's right. Apollo 1, you lose three heroic astronauts on the launch pad during a test, not even the launch. And that is almost enough to derail NASA right there. They have to go through congressional hearings, and everybody is traumatized by the event. And then you have, as you point out, Apollo 6, which is just the second test of the Saturn V rocket, the only machine powerful enough to deliver men to the moon. And in its second test, it fails catastrophically. The next time they're going to fly the Saturn V is not an unmanned test to try to work out the problems on Apollo 6. It's going to be Apollo 8 with three men aboard, Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders. And they're not going into Earth orbit only. They're not going 853 miles above the Earth, which is the current altitude record at the time. They're going to go 240,000 miles away to the moon.
Let's talk about the individuals, because I was fascinated to learn more about them, and start with Frank Borman, who was a bit of an enigma in the space program in that he didn't want to become an astronaut for the traditional reasons. For him, it was about competition and especially beating the Russians.
It really was. And Frank Borman was considered perhaps the finest of NASA's astronauts, or one of the finest at least at the time. But he was very focused on defeating the Soviet Union in the space race. And you have to remember, at the time, space is seen as the ultimate battlefield. The superpower that controls space can also control it for military reasons. If you can control space, you can put soldiers in space, you can put military bases on the moon. There's really no end to the potential destruction one side can wreak on the other. And Borman sees this space race as the ultimate expression of the Cold War, and he's in it strictly to beat the Soviet Union. He is not enchanted by space or the idea of exploration or the thrill of rockets. He wants to defeat the Soviet Union.
In many ways, the polar opposite was Jim Lovell, who had dreamed of space flight from the time he was a young man, and as tightly wound as Frank Borman could be at times. Lovell, as you point out in the book, was the guy that you want to be going to space with or off on a fishing trip.
Yeah, he is one of the sweetest, most easygoing guys you'll ever run across. He grew up very poor in Milwaukee without a father. His father had been killed in a car accident when Jim was just a little boy. But he always dreamed of exploration. Even as a young boy, he loved the idea of exploring and pushing into the unknown. And as soon as he became aware of rockets in high school, he built his own rocket. And at the Naval Academy, when others were writing their graduation thesis about classic naval battles or naval strategy, Lovell was already writing about rockets and what it would mean to send men into space. So to him, it was a very romantic proposition. Make no mistake, he also understood and believed in the importance of beating the Soviet Union in the space race. But for him, it was a lot about exploration and about pushing into the unknown.
We're talking with Robert Kurson, author of Rocket Men, The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8, and the astronauts who made man's first journey to the moon. The third member of the crew, for me, was the most interesting guy because I knew the least about him going into the book. That's Bill Anders, who initially was very disappointed to be part of this Apollo 8 crew because he thought it would cost him and knew it would cost him a chance to eventually walk on the moon.
Right. Anders is 5 years younger than Lovell and Borman. And this Apollo 8 is going to be his first space flight. He's training as a lunar module pilot, which means that according to his calculations, he's got about an 80% or better chance of walking on the moon someday. But part of what makes the Apollo 8 flight so thrilling is that it's original mission was changed suddenly in the summer of 1968 from a low Earth orbital mission to the mankind's first journey to the moon. Now, that meant Apollo 8 was going to go without a lunar module. They were not going to land on the moon. And that's part of what makes this trip so daring and so dangerous and so thrilling. But it also meant that Anders had to change responsibilities. He was not going to be flying a lunar module anymore. And that meant he knew that his chances of walking on the moon had dropped to between slim and none. So at first, he's very discouraged by it. But then it occurs to him that going on Apollo 8 means he's going to be one of the first three human beings ever to leave Earth, and one of the first three human beings ever to arrive at a new world, at the new moon, at the moon. And so this becomes thrilling to him. He loves the idea of exploration. He's a scientist. He's a nuclear engineer, in addition to a top-rate fighter pilot. So for him, the idea of being the first and getting to explore this new world is a thrill beyond compare.
And he even tells his wife that he calculates there's about a one-third chance that he won't make it back from the moon. But he earns some toughness along the way from his dad. Can you share a little of that incredible story about his father?
Yeah, his father was a real war hero. He had been on a ship called the Panay, and this was during peacetime. But the Panay had been attacked by Japanese fighter planes, and it's an American ship, and it's a neutral party. They're attacked, and Anders' father acts so heroically. He's writing out orders in blood because he can't speak, and certainly would have received the Medal of Honor for his heroic actions. I think this is in 1937, if I'm not mistaken. He behaved in an unbelievably courageous way and saved so many lives. And this was made a very profound impression on his son, young Bill, who was nearby at the time. Bill was born in Hong Kong. And so this is something that stays with young Bill Anders and lives with him even into the time when he goes into space.
And even though he was a younger guy and Lovell and Borman knew each other, they'd spent nearly 2 weeks together on the Gemini 7 flight, but they grew to respect Bill Anders' work and ability very quickly.
Oh, they very much did. And you're right. Lovell and Borman flew aboard Gemini 7 for 14 days in a capsule the size, no bigger than the front seat of a Volkswagen Beetle. This was an unbelievable flight. It was done to see just how long astronauts could endure a flight. And when they got off onto the recovery ship, Lovell said, "We'd like to announce our engagement." So Lovell and Borman, even though they were quite different in terms of personality, really loved each other, and they were perfectly suited to fly together. When they met Anders, even though Anders was younger and would be making his first space flight about Apollo 8, they connected with him immediately, respected him, and soon enough, Borman believed that he had in his crewmates for Apollo 8 the finest astronaut crew NASA had ever assembled.
Well, he certainly had that, and then he had the technical expertise behind him as well, because this book is also a story about the people behind the scenes, the engineers, the aeronautical experts, the people like Chris Kraft, Deke Slayton, and so many others who pulled this all together, as you mentioned, in just 4 months' time, and that figure that stands out, the fact that man had never traveled more than 853 miles from the Earth, and now we're going to go a quarter of a million miles. It's remarkable to think about that exponential leap forward.
It's unbelievable. Normal space flights would take 12 to 18 months for training and preparation. This one rushed to the launch pad in 4 months for thrilling reasons, which I go into in the book. And I try not to make the book too technical by any means. It's really a human story. But they are taking such risks, not just in how short a time they have, 4 months to prepare for this whole thing, but they're going in all kinds of unknowns. Everything on this flight is going to be for the first time. And they're going, remember, just to orbit. They're not going to land. So they're going without a lunar module. And that meant that they're going without a backup engine, because the lunar module also serves as a backup engine. It would be the thing that saved Apollo 13 and Lovell on his next flight. But here, Apollo 8, for all the risks and everything, going without a backup engine, they're going on the Saturn V for the first time men are ever going to go aboard, and only the third flight ever after the second flight failed so badly in its second test. Everything is unknown. And when you go and listen to other astronauts, including Neil Armstrong, talk about Apollo 8, they speak about it in reverential terms. They sound different when they talk about Apollo 8 than even when they talk about their own flight. And that's a big part of the reason, is because when Apollo 11 went and they landed on the moon, they already knew so much of it could be done, because Apollo 8 proved it. But when Apollo 8 went, nobody knew that any of that could be done with men aboard.
And there were so many technical challenges along the way that they were undertaking for the first time, escaping Earth's orbit, getting themselves into the moon's orbit, and all of those so precise that one minor mistake either way, and you find yourself trapped in space or forever circling the moon.
That's absolutely true. And remember, on top of that, not only were they taking these risks of smashing into the moon or being trapped in lunar orbit or flying off into solar orbit forever, they are going on Christmas Eve and Christmas. They're going to be orbiting the moon. So as NASA's chief pointed out when he screamed in fury at the idea of this mission, if anything goes wrong and these guys die out there, no one will ever look at the moon or at Christmas the same again.
Yeah, and you include a letter in the book that's wonderful from a citizen who wrote into NASA urging them to postpone for a month or so because of the possibility of Christmas always bearing the memory of the loss of these astronauts.
Yes, he begged them not to do it, not just because Christmas was at risk, but because so much else had gone wrong in this terrible year of 1968. It was one horror after another, and here they're going to go on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day at the end of one of the worst years in our country's history. And if something goes wrong, then the man points out, what does that mean for the rest of us?
One of the most thrilling parts of the book, and as I told you, I knew how it ended, but I was still on the edge of my seat, was this important maneuver called the TEI. And I believe that's what enabled them to escape the moon's gravitation or the moon's orbit and begin their trip back to Earth. And even though I knew how it ended, I was hanging on every word.
Yes, that's one of the most dangerous maneuvers. Many people in Mission Control believe that the single most risky maneuver, because to get out of lunar orbit and head back home, the engine, their single engine that they have, has to relight, and it has to perform near perfectly. And if the thing doesn't relight again or it has problems, they're trapped forever in lunar orbit, or close to forever. Ultimately, they'll probably crash into the lunar surface. But that single engine has to relight, and they have to gain enough speed to escape lunar gravity and head back home. And nobody knew if that would happen because, again, nobody had ever tried any of this before.
Well, there was the science, there was the exploration, there was paving the way for the Apollo 11 landing 7 months later. But then there was the wonder that perhaps nobody could have planned for, that they saw when they emerged from the dark side of the moon and saw the Earth for the first time and captured in that incredible photograph by Bill Anders.
Right. Anders was charged with the photographic responsibility for the trip, and they trained in these 4 months so hard on studying the moon, to photograph the moon, to scout for possible landing sites for what would be Apollo 11, and to study the moon. And, you know, they are the first humans to lay eyes on the far side of the moon. But on the fourth revolution, Borman changed the orientation of the spacecraft, and the men could see this lunar, gray, featureless lunar horizon set against a black infinity of space. But all of a sudden, a blue jewel begins to rise over the lunar horizon. And they realize suddenly that that's Earth. It's Earthrise. And it is the single most beautiful thing any of them has ever seen. And they scramble for their cameras. Anders gets a beautiful telephoto lens with a color film magazine, and he snaps off pictures of the first Earthrise ever witnessed by human beings, and it changes them fundamentally. And when they spoke to me about what it was like to see Earthrise, it was so beautiful and so profound the way they described it. Each of them was changed from it. And of course, we all know that photograph. You can make a good argument. It's the single most famous photograph and maybe most important photograph ever taken.
And along with that photograph, what is most memorable and continues 50 years later about that flight is what happened in their broadcast, their Christmas time broadcast. And I was fascinated to read that Frank Borman wanted no part of doing any of these broadcasts. But for this one in particular, they reached out to the astronauts from Houston and said, do whatever you want. Everything had been planned down to the last detail, but the broadcast that made this flight so famous and such an important landmark in human history, they came up with on their own.
They did, and that Borman laughs about it today, 50 years later. He still can't believe it. He said, can you imagine now if you're going to be speaking to more people than had ever listened to a human voice at once? And that's what they were told. Nearly a third of the world's population would be tuning in. It would go through 100 committees and all kinds of oversight, but they just left it to the astronauts. And ultimately, the astronauts, with the help of some friends, came up with what they thought was the perfect and appropriate thing, but they didn't tell anyone. They just wrote it on the fireproof paper, put it in their flight plan. Their wives didn't know. NASA didn't know. Nothing. But on the Ninth Revolution, while they were speaking to nearly a third of the world's population, they read from the book of Genesis. In the beginning, they said, and it moved people across the world. Nobody could believe what they were hearing. This was an origin story. And it spoke to so many of the world's religions and so many people in the world. It seemed the very most perfect thing to say for mankind's first trip away from home and first arrival at a new world. And after they were done speaking, it only took about a minute and a half for them to finish reading what they'd chosen. People all over the world streamed out of their homes and out of apartments, out of stores, out of saloons, all around the world. And they looked toward the sky, many of them sobbing from the emotion of the moment, knowing they could not see Apollo 8 from the ground, of course, but looking all the same. It was a profound, incredible moment. And you could go on YouTube right now and watch a video of it and hear them speak, and it's as powerful today as it was 50 years ago.
I was tearing up reading it in the book when I got to that, and I was so moved by the story you share in the book of legendary conductor Leonard Bernstein.
Yes, he was very suspect of the space program. He thought it cost way too much money, that it was not doing nearly the good that could be done otherwise with the money. He was very much against even watching this thing, but he was at a party where the broadcast was being watched, and reluctantly he forced himself kind of out of the corner of his eye to watch, and was reduced to tears, as millions of people were. There was no escaping that something unbelievable had happened, something almost impossible, and something that would never, ever happen again. No matter how many more space flights were taken, nobody would ever arrive for the first time again, and it overwhelmed him.
We're talking with Robert Kurson, his wonderful book, Rocket Man, and Tom Wolfe coined the phrase, the right stuff. And we often talk about it here as birthdays roll around. It's incredible how many of these Apollo astronauts are alive, and this entire crew in their 80s and early 90s still alive. And to me, that's a mark of the stuff that they were made of.
It really is. And, you know, one of the things I've discovered when I first began work on this book and I first started to meet with the astronauts at their homes was that the importance of their wives in the story and the family. So these three women they married, by the way, the Apollo 8 crew is the only crew in Apollo or Gemini in which all the marriages survived. Marriage was a very challenging proposition for astronauts. It was a very difficult life. But these three marriages survived, and they talked to me. It seemed almost impossible for them to talk about their success as astronauts or what they accomplished without crediting their wives first and foremost. And that became a part of the story I hadn't expected at first, but it was a wonderful part, and you really get to see just what these guys were made of, not just as astronauts, but they had the right stuff as gentlemen also. It's hard for me to imagine in my life meeting three nicer, more ordinary guys, if you can believe it, but they really did have the right stuff all the way around.
That is Robert Kurson talking about his book, Rocket Men, here on the Best of Downtown. Thanks to Rob, thanks to Terry Virts, and also to author John Connolly as well for joining us here on your Sunday morning. Tomorrow on the program, Live Goodness, beginning at 4 o'clock, we'll talk sports. Nick Coit on the Boston scene from ABC6 in Providence. Mike Lowe of the Portland Press Herald. Maine Baseball's Nick Durba. Alan Adams of the Maine Edge with movie reviews on Pass the Popcorn. And great stuff coming up throughout the week. Tuesday on the show, actor-comedian Jay Moore. Actor William Sanderson of Deadwood, True Blood, and Newhart. He being Larry of Larry, Daryl, and Daryl fame. Also later in the week, author Anne Britting Olsen, burlesque star Ulla Uberbusen, and a whole lot more this week on Downtown. Thanks for joining us and making us a part of your Sunday morning. Hope the rest of your weekend goes well. Have you begun the packing process for your trip, Gary?
I have not begun packing because I've been mowing the lawn.
Aha.
My back lawn, as soon as you get a temperature above 70, needs to be mowed.
Mine, not so much, and that's fine. I can wait a while. I raked. I didn't enjoy that, but I did it. My first time raking the new house. So it's not even my leaves. It's leaves that were left behind by the old tenants, the old owners. So, yeah, I'm doing their work for them. But anyway, good to be doing that kind of thing. Good to be enjoying springtime.
Yes.
What passes for it now, where we just shift immediately from winter to summer. Spring is like 4 days of mud. That's okay. We're good with that. Hey, we got a great week of, is this? No, this is your last week. no, before vacation. Oh, you have 2 weeks.
Two.
Oh, hell. Yeah, no need to start packing.
No, no.
Yeah, Loretta's taking care of all that anyway. I know. I know how it works.
Yeah, I just pack the essentials. You know, the cooler.
Yeah, that's huge when you're driving nonstop.
The chairs.
Yes. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Perfect. Well, you enjoy the rest of your Sunday. That goes for you as well. We'll see you tomorrow afternoon at 4 right here in downtown. You're going to be all right.